I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The latest in the unheralded Artists of BC series from Mother Tongue Publishing, the eighth book, was released earlier this summer. Peter Busby is the author of The Life and Art of Jack Aykroyd. Its subject was born in 1921 in Halifax, Yorkshire, was an engineering apprentice before serving 5 years in the Royal Air Force during World War II. He immigrated to Canada, spent 4 years at the Ontario College of Art before moving west and living in Nanaimo and subsequently to Vancouver, living in Kitsilano on U Street, where a lot of artists in the early 1960s lived. Mr. Busby joins me now, recounts his fascinating life from the artists of the era he fell in with, as well as his artwork. He supported himself by fixing kilns for local schools and potters, as well he was an assistant to sculptors. He went to Japan twice, spending a lot of time learning the culture and immersing himself with its people. It influenced his art and later led to exhibitions in Japan where he was admired. I'll get Peter Busby to tell us about his book and the life of Jack Aykroyd, the artistic scene here in Vancouver in those years, and why Aykroyd ought to be remembered. Peter Busby was born in West Yorkshire. He studied English at Sheffield and Leeds Universities before moving to Canada. He taught English in Britain, where he also wrote two thrillers and a television series, Thin Air. He's worked as an editor and ghostwriter. For his children's book, First to Fly, he received the 2003 James Madison Award for American Nonfiction. Please welcome to the Plant Online program. In studio, as it were, Peter Busby. Mr. Busby, good morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for joining us. By the way, is it pronounced Aykroyd?
He pronounced it Aykroyd by family tradition, but very few people followed that. Most people called him Aykroyd, so we can use either.
We can use Aykroyd. Did you know him at all?
No, I didn't. He died in 1996. I was already in Canada at that point, but no, I didn't know him.
So where he was born and where you were born, how close is that?
About 10 miles.
Ah, okay. So you have a sense of where he came from?
And, I do, yeah. Yes.
What sort of childhood was it?
For him?
Yeah.
Well, Halifax, where he was from, some of your listeners may know it from the television series Last Tango in Halifax. It's an industrial town in textiles and the wool industry with hilly surrounds full of sheep. And his father came from such a community and subsequently trained as an engineer. And when Aykroyd was three, his father got a top job in Swindon, Wiltshire, in the south of England, where he worked for the railways in heating. And so Jack moved to Swindon at that age. So he felt strongly his connection with Yorkshire, but he wouldn't have had any actual memories of living there except going back there a couple of times a year to visit with his extended family.
And eventually he left it, came to this country, and stayed away for a long time, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
What was the cause of that? I mean, were there family problems that caused the exile, if you will?
Yes, but I'd like to go back to his war service first.
Sure.
Because in the RAF, he was a mechanic because he had been an engineering apprentice. And in Canada, there was a training program for air crew, and he served on that. He lived in Canada for 3 years. And, in fact, was in Vancouver at the time of D-Day. And when he was in Vancouver, he promised to himself that he would come back here and eventually live here. So it was a long-standing ambition of his to move to Vancouver. But having gone home to Swindon after the war and gone back to his old job, there was an immense amount of frustration with his family and with his setting because he lived overseas for several years. It didn't contain him anymore, and he couldn't get into art school as he always wanted. So eventually he just upped and left and came to Canada and worked on the railways first here before he then went to art school in Toronto in 1949.
And there was a point in his life where he never saw his parents again, is that right?
That's right. He didn't go back from 1948 to 1986, nearly 40 years, by which time his parents were both dead. His sister was alive and still is alive. And she was displeased with him because he had upped and left her with the responsibility of looking after the aged parents. So there was a bit of a rift there.
Did they know of his work as an artist at all, the parents and the sister who were in Britain?
He used to send his paintings to his sister as gifts, but I gather from others that she didn't treasure them so much.
Did you talk to her at all in the course of writing this book?
No, I tried. She's very old and reluctant to speak on the phone. Uh-huh. But as well, she was reluctant to speak about him, but I did speak to her husband, who was younger than her, in their home in Hampshire in England, and he told me that of her feelings about him. So it was a bit of a sad story there, that was never fully resolved. Though he did go back to England twice in 86, as I mentioned, and again 7 years later.
And then she'd come here, and they'd gone to Banff for one point, right?
Yeah, she came here and stayed with him, and he wanted her to stay with him, though there were offers to stay in other friends' more salubrious settings. And she was dismayed by the poverty of his life, because he didn't feel he was poor, because he was accustomed to a low level of income and expenditure, and she found that a little difficult. But they did go on holiday together, and so they patched it up to some extent.
Yeah. Had he always, because you describe in the book the conditions in which he had to stay, and his apartment was dirty, there were rats.
Mm-hmm.
Did he always live like that?
Yes, pretty much.
Yeah,
yes.
Right up to the end.
Yes, yes. Well, he left, he lived in New Street for about 30 years in a community that included Frank Molnar and Eliki Moretti and other artists. But eventually, one by one, they all left, and he moved to another apartment that was probably a little more comfortable.
Yeah. So, was it common then for artists, not only in this series, but sort of as contemporaries, that they lived in such conditions? That it was. I guess that's the bohemian experience, isn't it?
Is it any different now?
Yeah, I guess probably not. No. Yeah. So in the process of writing this book, what I found fascinating is because there are some diaries that he kept, journals that he kept, mainly from his time in Japan, which we'll touch on in a sec, because that was obviously such an impactful time for him, his life, his work. But another thing that you do throughout the book is you recreate his life, the timeline, if you will, through address books. So you found a lot of those, did you?
His address books.
Yeah.
It's strange things happens when you write a biography, that information suddenly materializes when you most need it, as if the subject from beyond the grave has sent it your way. And late in the project, I was looking through his sketchbooks, and in the very last sketchbook, he wrote a list of his addresses. My first thought was, if only I'd seen that a year ago, it would save me a lot of work. But you need these little things to construct someone's movement, and also to his present address book, that too, and you look through the photographs in his photograph album to find out who his friends were and see who you can chase up and so on.
So he was born in 1921, so I'm assuming that a lot of people his age are no longer with us.
Yes, fortunately. He had a lot of friends who were 10 years or more younger than him or who are still with us. Frank Molnar, the painter who was Jack's sketching partner, they used to go to the Okanagan every year. He's still alive. He was very helpful. and others, his executor, Brian Batsford, and several others.
And you got to talk to people like your publisher, Mona Fertig, and Brian Lynch over at the Georgia Strait.
Yes.
Who knew Jack Aykroyd because their parents knew him.
Yes.
And so the perspective that you had from them as, say, young people seeing this guy, I mean, that must have been interesting, too, because they met him, obviously, and not to mention knew him somewhat.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. He had a great affinity with younger people. I spoke to several young people who were teenagers and young people at the time, who often used to come by his studio and hang out there, and he'd just carry on working, and they'd hang out, they'd chat, and they felt very much at home there. And Brian Lynch had a connection with him as well. He worked for Jack one summer. Jack had this gig repairing kilns, and Brian Lynch was his assistant for a summer, so Brian spent the whole summer working with him. And as well, he knew him through the various family events that took place.
So this was a fascinating life, otherwise you wouldn't have written this book.
Yes, yes. I found it fascinating.
Yeah, and you've already told us about some of the things you've had to do to reconstruct the life. I mean,
yes.
I'm quite interested, actually, in the address books, because, you know, that's... So in the course of writing this book, because you obviously, there have been no other books written about him.
Yes.
What were you able to find out about him that you'd like us, the reader, to know? Because he's obviously a great artist. He's done a lot of work that if you read this book, it's a handsome book, so you'll find a lot of his work featured therein. He's someone that we need to remember because he's part of the history of this place.
I think what makes him especially interesting, aside from his great skills in drawing and painting, is that he combined his interests in England and in Canada and in Japan. And one of his last pictures, self-portrait, where he's sitting on a beach near Tofino, looking out to sea. And if you think about it, he's looking towards Japan, and placed strategically in the composition, there is a Japanese fishing float. And through many of his pictures, he combines the imagery of England and Japan and Canada. One of the most apt ones for me is one of his final pictures, where you see polar bears sitting on a Stonehenge-type plinth inside a torii gate. The torii gate is the ceremonial gate at the entrance of temples in Japan. And as you mentioned earlier, he made several visits to Japan. He was there for 6 months in 1960. He returned 5 years later for another 8 months, where he actually worked in a pottery, that is father and son type business in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. He was very interested in ceramics. And made many connections, as a result of which he had three exhibitions there in 1987.
So I mentioned there are these detailed journals for his time in Japan. And so do you get a sense of what drew him there? I mean, there were obvious things about Japan that I think would draw anyone
yes.
there. But for him, I mean,
yes.
it must have, because he certainly planned it out, didn't he, in terms
yes.
of where he was going and what he would do while there.
Yes, yes. There are hints of what might have interested him. He, when he was at art school, there were two Japanese women in the class with him. He had a friend who had partly Japanese heritage, who he talked to a lot. He knew Japan from an art from an art point of view, from his art studies. And but the real clincher, I'm not quite sure of. It's particularly interesting at that time because, as a man who came of age during the war, the idea of Japan for people of his generation was Japanese prisoner of war camps and people being treated very badly, which is true. It actually happened, but that's obviously not the totality of Japan. And it's interesting he was able to look beyond that stereotype, and he was fascinated by the soul of the country, by the temples, by the art, by the natural beauty, by the people. He had tremendous affinity with the country.
So the I guess the first visit, that would have been in the early 60s?
1960, yes.
1960, yeah. And what I found fascinating is he planned it. He had a budget for it. He had, $2,000?
Something like that,
yeah, which was finished by the time he got to Vancouver.
Yes.
But the way he planned his journey, because, most tourists go to the metropolitan centers and then go out, if they have the time to go out, into more rural parts of a country. But he did it the other way, which impressed the Japanese that he encountered.
Yes, yes.
So that right away, there's an understanding of the people in this country.
Yes,
that most people wouldn't have.
Yes, yes. He went to places where they'd never seen a European before. He started off in the far north, where nobody used to go then. And he was searching for the most, I suppose, he wanted the totality of Japan, not just the obvious bits of it. And then he ended up in Kyoto and Tokyo.
And where was it that he met Emiko?
In Kyoto.
Yeah, and having looked at the life of Aykroyd, that was the love of his life?
Yes, you'd have to say yes, it was. Yes.
So what was the nature of the relationship?
She worked in a bar, and so he met her in a bar, and he courted her. They went out together to various beauty spots, who went to movies, and eventually they formed a sexual relationship, and he wanted to marry her, and she demurred partly because her parents were going to be financially dependent on her, and she had an obligation to them. And perhaps also she felt that he might not be able to support her, because she probably realized that he was never going to be rich. Mm-hmm. But for one reason or another, it didn't happen. And 5 years later, he came back and again tried to marry her, and again she turned him down.
And in his journals, does he talk about sort of being turned down and what that meant to him, because he's quite effusive in from what you've written in the book about what she meant to him and how fascinated he was by her and how much in love. A lot of it was lust as well. He felt towards her. So when the break did happen, was he reflective on that at all?
I can't say yes. I can't say that he was particularly insightful about her side of the story. It was just heartbreaking for him, and that's what he talked about. But unfortunately, I only have a diary from the first trip. It would have been very interesting to have to see how he felt about that 5 years later.
And he talked about her with friends of his here.
Yes.
A great deal?
Yes.
Yeah. And you have at the back of the book one of the last, I guess, portraits that he's done of...
Yes.
Of her, right?
Yes.
Which I found interesting because they encountered each other in the 60s, and he depicted her sort of as she would have been in the 1990s?
Well, that's a very interesting question.
You don't think so?
I can't say that. Yeah. I can't say yes or no. I asked lots of people, everyone who I talked to about this. I said, "How old do you think she is in that picture? How old do you think she is?"
She looks, I would say, from mid-40s to... People look younger nowadays, so maybe even the early 60s, you know?
Uh-huh.
I mean, Asians tend to dye their hair, too, so... I could see her being in her 60s with pitch black hair like that, you know?
Well, I got many answers to that question, and... In fact, in his diaries, he never says how old she is. But he told a friend of his indicated she'd be in her 30s in 1960. But it struck me, as you mentioned, that in the I should explain first,
yeah,
the circumstances of the portrait. The portrait is the last piece of work that he worked on. It is unfinished. Mm. So he was working on that actually when he died, and he died suddenly. He had a heart attack on a bus, so the painting is unfinished. So I found that uncanny that's what he was working on at the moment of his death. And when I talked to people about how old she was, it was in my mind as well, as you mentioned, that he had perhaps aged her into who she might have become.
Yeah.
Because he would have started from a photograph that he took 30 years ago. We never found the photograph, unfortunately. That would have been really interesting. In fact, we never found a photograph of her at all.
Mm. Yeah. When you look at his art, and he worked, did he work in one medium more than another, say?
He had three main media. He oil was not one of them. He gave up doing oil when he was in art school. His preferred medium was egg tempera, which is a kind of powder paint where you brush, you dip the brush in egg, and that gives the result a particular kind of texture that he very much liked. It's a technique that requires thousands of tiny brush strokes, something that came naturally to him with his meticulous personality. Egg tempera he used mainly for landscapes. He did a lot of landscapes in his life. He also painted in poster paint, also known as gouache. And he did a lot of drawings. And by drawings, some of them were on white paper with pencil. Some of them were on colored paper with colored pencils and with colored inks as well as with paint. So they were kind of a mixture of drawings and paintings. He was a terrific drawer.
Mm-hmm.
As a child, he saw himself mainly as a drawer. And when he went to art school, it was the object of drawing better. And it took him a lifetime to become as good at painting as he was at drawing.
And so when you look at his work, how much of it, by the way, is still around that you were able to see in the course of writing this? I mean, I'm assuming that some pieces have been lost, have they?
We reckon there are about 500 pieces altogether.
Okay.
Total.
Yeah.
100 of them are in Japan. So mostly, a few of them were available to us, but mostly they weren't, except for photographs.
So,
and another 100 were in Ottawa because he had a big market there. But I reckon I saw at least half of his pictures, maybe 200 to 300.
And critically, how are they viewed by, say, art critics or aficionados of art?
He's mostly ignored. is the short answer.
Yeah, some people bought his work. People like his work.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Those who own his work are passionate admirers of his. Burnaby Art Gallery has a large collection, and they appreciate him.
Now, looking at his art as his biographer, do you have any insight into his life? I mean, did he use his art as a way of autobiography, perhaps? I know he used it as nostalgia because he liked remembering, say, what he saw and like to put that, I guess, in a piece of art to capture that moment back. I mean, when you look at some of his pieces, do you learn something about him?
When I think about that question, I think of a quotation from a famous writer. It might have been Doris Lessing, but it might not, who said, "When I start off writing about myself, I end up writing about someone else. And when I start off writing about someone else, I end up writing about myself." I think it was much the same with his work. There are many elements in it that are autobiographical, but whether they are really saying anything about him or just ideas that he's dredged up to apply to something that's outside himself, that is a matter of speculation, and that's what is particularly interesting about him, is to see how he took these private elements and made a more universal application of them.
Yeah, it's just when I look through this book, and there are a number of pieces of his work in this book, I come away with more questions about him than the answers that you obviously provide in the text.
Yes, yes.
It's a marvelous mystery, isn't it, about reconstructing a life? And
It is, yes. What kind of questions come to mind?
Well, I'm like you, I wish there was more written material, I guess. You know,
yes.
I mean, I do want, when I look at some of the work, I wonder why he would have done whatever it is that I'm looking at.
Yes,
and what that meant to him. I mean, it's easier, I think, if one has a journal or a diary, because you can write down what you actually think. But in a painting, it's a little more abstract, I guess.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, he was very private. He wasn't going to give away any hostages to curious biographers.
Or readers of biographers, I guess. In another era, would Aykroyd have been better known, do you think?
I think so, yes. Because he operated in a figurative way, which was not so fashionable in the 60s and 70s and 80s, he was up bucking against the trend. But nowadays, I think there is room for artists with many different styles and approaches. And I think, as well, he would have had a terrific career as a graphic novelist, for instance, or cartoonist, or in one of those sort of fields of art, more narrative fields of art. He had a great sense of story. Often in his paintings, you have the sense that something is happening, but you're not sure what it is, or something has just happened or is about to happen, which makes it very intriguing. And
a lot of it is quite mesmerizing, because then you're looking at nearly everything in the piece. There's a lot going on, some of these pieces.
There's a lot going on, yeah.
I'm looking at one piece here of people at the art gallery.
Yes.
And, I mean, there's a lot of people in it, a lot of different people in it. You know, you've got hippies, you've got older people, you have, I guess, people that work in the gallery. And they're all looking at each other, they're looking at the pieces of art.
Yes.
And it's almost like if you look at it long enough, you can see the people move.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yes. Yes, one challenge for me writing the book is on first impression, you look at the paintings and you think, well, there's a lot of stuff going on here. It's quite intriguing, but how do I read it? And over the course of months looking at these works, I could read more and more and see more and more where things came from.
And did he dwell on, say, what he meant in his work? I mean, that's something that a lot of us, as we look at his work in this book, are thinking about what he meant. But as you write at the back of the book, he didn't really care, did he? Or he wasn't preoccupied with it, as, say, you and I might be.
He wasn't a manifesto guy. Which probably held him back professionally. He was very reluctant to explain what was happening. Although, in private conversations, he did. There are a couple of paintings here where I relate what he told the owners of what was going on. But in general, he preferred to remain mysterious from that point of view.
Now, he worked as a sculptor's assistant, and so he had a hand in the Begbie statue that's in New Westminster.
Yes.
It? Yeah. And then what did he do with the girl in the wetsuit in Stanley Park?
Sculptors always need a grunt to do the heavy work, and these pieces are very heavy to manipulate. You need to carry them around and make molds and. I don't really understand this stuff myself
yeah.
very well.
So he was involved in the making of these two in yes. particular, right?
Many pieces with Eliakim Reddy. Most famously, the one in off Stanley Park in the water,
yeah.
girl in wetsuit,
mm-hmm.
which Im Reddy was initially asked to make a copy of the mermaid in Copenhagen. And ended up making that, which is a real Vancouver landmark.
It's iconic, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, everybody goes by there. Everybody
yeah.
knows it, even tourists.
The
other thing that's fascinating, not only in this book but in this series, because a lot of these folks in this book and in the previous seven all knew each other. They're from the same era.
Yes.
And it's Vancouver in the late 50s through to the 70s.
Yeah.
You told me as we came in here today that you'd come to Canada in the late 80s, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So looking back at this time, for people listening, what was Vancouver like in those heady days of the 1960s? I mean, the world was changing a great deal around us, but in Vancouver in particular, it was a vibrant art scene, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, and it was somewhat San Francisco North. I actually came to Vancouver as a student in 1967. I spent several days here. It was very hippie. Of course, Jack was pre-hippie, so this was something that he would have been fascinated by, but wasn't really...
a participant.
No. Yeah. He wasn't a beads guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a World War II veteran.
Yes,
right? So,
exactly.
because there's a blurb at the back from Max Wyman, which was quite fascinating in reading the book and thinking about it, is that really in that era, this town changed. I mean, you know, for a lot of people, it's still a provincial backwater, but at that point, the move to becoming a metropolitan, cosmopolitan city, you can sort of see the genesis of that there.
Yes, yes,
yeah.
yes. And Jack, as a former engineer who worked as a draftsman, he was always interested in construction. In fact, there's a painting featured in the book that belongs to the Vancouver Art Gallery of downtown structures. The last film in his camera when he died in
1996
contains images of the recently built library, the Colosseum-type library. He was obviously fascinated by this. He was a great observer of the changes taking place in the city, and many of these things are reflected in his paintings.
Yeah, as someone who lives here, it'd be interesting to know what he thinks of how it's changed and how quickly it's changed, even in the 19 years since his death.
Yes, yes.
Did you enjoy writing this book?
I did, very much, yes. Yeah. I enjoyed the detective story. I love his paintings even more than when I started. I like him personally. I feel I understand where he's come from and where he went to and why and what moved him. I think his connections between Japan and England and Canada are very interesting. He's very interested in identity and the various emblems and symbols of these countries and how they all get jumbled up in his art. I love his work, and I like him personally, and I very much enjoy doing the book.
Did you encounter any film or audio of him?
No, I didn't.
Did you ask any of the people that knew him what he sounded like?
Yes, I did.
Did he have the accent?
Well, being English myself, English people are very aware of accents, so I asked. But Canadians are not as aware of accents as English people, so I didn't get many interesting replies.
Peter, it's been a pleasure meeting you and in reading this book. It's a fascinating life, as you've already told us, and people who are listening to us who are intrigued by Jack and about his work ought to pick it up. Thanks for coming in to do this, and good luck with the book.
Thank you, Joe. It's a great pleasure.
The book is called The Life and Art of Jack Aykroyd, the eighth book in the Outstanding Unheralded Artists of BC series from Mona Fertig and Mother Tongue Publishing. It's author Peter Busby. Join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunter.